From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later next hour, Moonlight Madness, open lines. Well, here's some stories of the day. I don't want to say I told you so, but the Food and Drug Administration staffers are now recommending new warnings about psychiatric events observed in some patients taking Roche Holdings Tamiflu and GlaxoSmithKline's Relenza. An FDA advisory panel will review the recommendations for the antiviral influenza drugs at a meeting next week. The FDA held a similar meeting 2 years ago in response to reports of a dozen deaths of children in Japan who had been taking Tamiflu. Experts then found no evidence of a direct connection between the drug and the deaths, although the FDA did ultimately update Tamiflu's label to add a caution urging close monitoring of patients for abnormal behavior such as delirium or self-injury. In Maryland, a man shot and killed his ex-wife and their three children and then himself in a small-town park as the woman prepared to hand over the children in custody. The bodies were found in the tiny community of Unity when Maryland National Capitol Police officers stopped in the deserted park after noticing two cars with their engines running. Three suspected Al-Qaeda militants beheaded an Iraqi couple right in front of their children. The suspected militants were reportedly related to the victims, and they told a family uncle the male victim was an infidel because he wore Western-style trousers and he did not pray. Rock singer Marilyn Manson has been accused of squandering his band's profit on a child's skeleton and masks made of human skin. The keyboardist, Stephen Pogo Beyer, filed a breach of contract lawsuit in August in which he accused Manson of taking cash belonging to the rest of the band to pay for what he said, sick and disturbing purchases. More than 150 passengers and crew took the lifeboats in Antarctic waters after their cruise ship hit an object and began taking on water through a hole in the hull. It was believed that the passengers of the Explorer, which is a Liberian-flagged vessel, included at least 22 British citizens and a number of Americans and Canadians. No injuries reported. Well, shoppers who've been hibernating in recent months because of worries about rising gas prices, falling home values, they jammed malls and stores for pre-dawn discounts on everything from televisions to toys to the official start of Christmas shopping. With the economy relying heavily on the consumer, it's a crucial thing that the Black Friday euphoria lasts throughout the season. It's expected to be the weakest, they say, though, in 5 years. I know some people who at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning headed out for the stores just to get in line. Not me. And surgeons removed a massive 10-pound hairball from the stomach of an 18-year-old girl suffering from a psychological condition in which she ate her own hair. This according to a report in the New England Journal of Medicine. The teen went to her doctor after complaining of stomach pains and vomiting. She had lost 40 pounds over a five-month period. Doctors in Chicago carried out a scan, and they were amazed to find the huge mass of this hairball blocking her entire stomach. The hairball measured 15 inches by 7 inches when it was removed. By 7, just imagine that. Once the hairball was removed, the patient was discharged. A year later, they say, she's gained 20 pounds and has stopped eating her own hair. Muggers snatched an Austrian woman's handbag, unaware that it contained nothing but a dead rabbit. The two thieves took the 42-year-old woman's handbag as she was about to catch a train to a countryside with her daughter because they were going to bury the pet. She simply said, "Well, they saved us the trip. I told my daughter they were angels and were taking Bunny to a better place." In a moment, one of our own, Richard C. Hoagland, joins us to update us on that incredible comet Holmes that seems to have blown up in midair, or mid-universe, as I say. And then we'll talk with Richard about some other things this hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, we're bringing in science advisor and the head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, and also now author with Mike Barra of Dark Mission, which has become a New York Times bestseller. Richard, happy Thanksgiving to you and Robin, my friend.
And happy Thanksgiving to you and our very, very beloved, and I say that with deep affection, Coast audience.
Did you have a great Thanksgiving meal yesterday?
We had a wonderful meal. You know, Robin is a super cook.
Yes, and she's also a health nut, so I can envision her right now feeding you with a calorie counter, measuring your turkey, and giving you just the right portions.
You know, Robin never ceases to amaze me at her culinary, shall we say, imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that nothing is ever exactly the same twice. But it's superb.
Nothing's ever as it seems, Richard. You know that.
That's right. Hey,
you know, yesterday we had our 44th anniversary JFK special on the program. We were live on Thanksgiving night. And you, a couple weeks ago, held that press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., when you unveiled Dark Mission. And you talked a little bit about NASA. You got a lot of Russian coverage there, much more than most people get from the Russians. But you were talking about some kind of tie-in with Kennedy, Khrushchev, and some other possibilities as well. I wanted you to go into that for a little bit before we go into Comet Holmes and some other issues.
Okay. One of the most surprising things to Mike and me was the discovery of the connection to our research into alien artifacts in the solar system and what NASA's been covering up all these years to the Kennedy assassination. I mean, this is something that he and I never, ever imagined we would come anywhere near, you know, in five light years. And we debated very seriously between us whether we were going to even put this in the book, because it is almost at some level a distraction. I mean, here we have an agency of the U.S. government, which we have proven in Dark Mission with all kinds of imagery and memos and documents, and Ken Johnston's first-person testimony has been withholding the most astonishing scientific discoveries of you know, human history from the American people and the rest of the world. And as a byproduct, we discovered documentation, U.S. government documentation, that in fact it could be even more serious for those of us who were, you know, followers of the president, mm-hmm. and who grew up. I mean, you know, and I know that you can ask anybody almost in this country, let alone this planet, where they were the afternoon of November 22nd, 1963, and they can tell you.
Yes.
I mean, it's blazoned in my mind where I was and how shocked I was and what happened over the succeeding weekend. Well, to find that there's a connection between what NASA's been hiding and the president's murder, as I listened to your program last night, I was really intrigued that one of the clips that you played was John Kennedy's ringing call to go to the moon.
Yes, yeah. Just one of those classics, isn't it?
Absolutely. So here's the connection. What we've discovered is that shortly after the president was inaugurated in January of 1960, he opened up a secret back channel to Chairman then Gorbachev. Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, and kept that channel going up until literally a few days before his death. And what he was trying to get the chairman to agree to, and it took him 3 years to do it, was to basically, and this is what blew me and Mike away, basically to merge the two major space programs on this planet, the U.S. and the Soviet program, and go to the moon together.
Now, was that initiated by Kennedy?
Yes.
And what was Khrushchev's reaction? I mean, here's the guy who took his shoe off at the United Nations, pounding it, claiming he was going to bury us.
Well, initially, Chairman Khrushchev said no, yet, and kept saying yet. Year after year after year, there were meetings between the president and the ambassador Gromyko in the White House, mm-hmm. where this came up. There were discussions that we now have, on tape recordings that Kennedy made with James Webb, who was the head of NASA. There was a speech that was given on September 20th, 1963, at the United Nations, where this all came out, and the president, before the entire world, made public what he had been privately for 3 years trying to get the Russians and the Soviets to agree to behind the scenes. What people don't realize is that on November 11th or 12th, according to Sergei Khrushchev, the chairman's son, the Nikita Khrushchev finally agreed with the president to join forces to go to the moon together, to put these two space programs in sync and to exchange hardware and astronauts and cosmonauts and come up with a way, technically, to go to the moon together.
Like we're doing right now with the International Space Station.
Exactly. Now, here's where things get very, very strange. Because if you remember the speech on May 25th, 1961, where the president stood in the vault of the House, addressed a joint session of the House and Senate, and the nation, and the world, and issued the ringing call for Apollo, one of the key reasons was to beat the Russians, to beat the Soviets to the moon.
Right.
To demonstrate the superiority of democracy, of freedom for the third world against the totalitarian communist system. That was supposedly what we were going to spend $20 billion in 1961 dollars, back when $1 billion was real money.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically were going to showcase what freedom could do all around the world by showing our technological prowess in beating the Soviet Union to a place that everyone had imagined going for all of human history, i.e. the moon. To know that within 2 weeks of that declaration, in Vienna, in June of that same year, the president sat with Khrushchev and really personally tried to persuade him to go with us together, and then kept these secret negotiations going, you know, letters and missives and, you know, meetings with ambassadors all the way up until November 11th or 12th of 1963, when, according to Khrushchev's son, the premier finally realized that here was a man he could deal with. And we believe that was basically because of what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Kennedy showed he was really made of steel. And he was not stampeded by advisors that wanted a war and wanted to invade Cuba. But, you know, he found an elegant and honorable way for both of us to back down from the brink, from the precipice. And it was after that that the premier, apparently according to his son, began looking at Kennedy, who he had dismissed as this rich kid in Vienna a couple of years before. He began to look at him as a real leader, as a real statesman. What I am absolutely convinced tonight, George, is that this is one of, and I listened to your guest last night very carefully.
And they all had their own theories.
Theories converged.
Yes, they did.
And there were a lot of different reasons why a lot of different groups would basically want Kennedy to go away. But what I've been looking for, you know, as soon as we found this evidence, was, is this the kind of tipping point reason? Was this the final straw? Because, remember, we were supposed to be in deadly combat, both psychologically and, if it ever came to it, a shooting war, i.e. the missile crisis, with the Soviets. And the idea that the president was willing to go to the moon with the Russians, I mean, it raises, in my mind, as we say in the book, profound questions about what NASA was really doing, why the president had announced we were going in a race to begin with, and why he finally got, you know, Chairman Khrushchev to agree to go together. And the only thing I can think of, George, that's big enough to have caused them to put their differences aside and to do this for the benefit of all mankind, which is what that plaque reads, is if there was something on the moon over and beyond rocks and craters and radiation and soil and that kind of stuff, i.e. real E.T. ruins, which, of course, the data that we present in Dark Mission shows resplendently are really there.
Man, you know what? You've got to add that theory to the mix, because I've got to tell you, had that truly been proposed at that time, the war machine would not have wanted that merger to occur.
Well, what's even more intriguing, and again, we have the documents, you know, citing this in the book, right after the president was killed and Lyndon Johnson took the reins as the new president, there was a piece of legislation inserted into the annual NASA appropriation that NASA could not, under pain of law, you know, synchronize its activities or cooperate with the Soviet Union unless there was specific you know, legislation voted through Congress to enable that to happen. And of course, the chairman of the committee was determined it would never happen. He was a co-Texan with Lyndon Johnson. So it really, really looks suspicious. And when you see the photographs of what happened the day that Kennedy was killed, particularly the infamous wink on Air Force One when Lyndon Johnson was taking the oath of office, mm-hmm. and Thomas, the chairman of this committee, literally moments after he's taken the oath, Johnson turns around, looks at him, and is obviously smiling. You can see that in the picture. And the chairman is winking at him, Chairman Thomas. So it's like there was this conspiracy to eliminate Kennedy because basically he was about to give away something so extraordinary, i.e. what NASA and this government could learn by going to the moon, finding technology, and then bringing it home and back engineering that technology. And we have one possible sample of that technology also in the book.
Would you have endorsed a joint space initiative between the Soviets and the United States at that time?
Let me cast my mind back. I mean, I was a jingoist.
It was a Cold War then, Richard. Things were tense.
They were very tense. It would all depend on what these two men said, because obviously they would have had to have come out with some explanation. And we know from other documents that Kennedy was definitely tossing over the traces. I thought it was so interesting last night. I don't know whether it was Robert Grodin or one of your other guests who basically said that Kennedy found his kahunas after the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
That he really saw that he could not trust any of his advisors that had already been there when he brought his administration in. And I was watching earlier in the evening a thing at Harvard with Ted Sorensen, who was one of the president's chief advisors and speechwriters, who wrote so many of those incredible resonant lines that the president would issue in those speeches that are now immortalized. And Sorensen said, he confirmed that after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy was incredibly suspicious of the Joint Chiefs. Remember, they were the ones who proposed Operation Northwoods, that we ourselves performed destructive terrorist acts on our own people and then blamed the Cubans so we could invade, you know, Castro and get rid of him. So I believe the president found his voice after the Bay of Pigs, and that it was those new insights into what the role of president had been reduced to and his decision to really be the president of all the people, up to and including violating the Brookings, you know, report, which recommended that if NASA ever found ruins, it keep them secret because we couldn't handle the truth, that famous line by Jack Nicholson.
Yep.
You quoted last night several times. So I think it was a cascade of all these various forces, Federal Reserve, Vietnam, war machine, Eisenhower's military-industrial complex. I mean, it almost reminds me of that famous scene in, is it Agatha Christie, The Murder on the Orient Express, where they all come in and kill the same body over and over again so that no one person can be blamed for the murder. There were so many factions that wanted to get rid of
it. It was amazing how many people wanted him out.
Yeah, because he was determined to really be the president of all the people. And after he was killed, you just look at history, this country has taken an incredibly disastrous turn. And it's only going to be up to the people listening to our voices if that turn continues, or in this coming election, we do something right for a change.
Everything we were concerned about and have been concerned about, he was addressing back in 1960 to 63.
Absolutely.
Everything. The Federal Reserve, the wars, everything.
I mean, Kennedy has been painted by a lot of his supporters as a hawk. I saw references just the other day that he was such an adamant hawk. That's why he agreed to Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this, of course, is completely undercut by what actually is history, which is he was willing to share going to the moon. Now, again, George, what could possibly cause an administration that was very concerned about money and budgets and how much Apollo was costing, what could cause a president to basically decide to do it with the Russians at all? I mean, why would one go to the moon at any point since it cost so much money unless it was for political gain? And what was the gain in basically saying to your enemy, okay, come with us?
Yeah, no, there would be none. You either do it on your own for your own gain, public relations and what have you. For him to do it with the Soviets, would have been one of two things. Either there was something very strange on the moon that he wanted us all to get there with, and or he was tired of the Cold War. We'll be back in a moment with New York Times bestseller Richard C. Hoagland. By the way, I should tell you that his book with Mike Barrett, Dark Mission, it's in the Barnes & Noble stores, but right before Christmas, you're going to see a front table with Dark Mission all over the place. We'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk about Comet Holmes. We're going to open up the phone lines, too, if you have a question for Richard C. Hoagland. And back with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, proud of you, by the way, and Mike Barra hitting that New York Times best-selling list. It is not an easy task, my friend, with Dark Mission.
It is not, and I thank you so much, and I really want to thank this audience because it proves to me what I've said over and over again. This is the most important and special audience of any media outlet in the world. And all those people out there who have followed our work and who followed, you know, me from art to you and beyond are making it real. I mean, they have literally brought this topic into the mainstream. There's an awful lot of people tonight who are taking a second and third and fourth look at our research because of this audience overwhelmingly. I mean, we're now into our fourth printing of Dark Mission.
That's amazing.
That is absolutely amazing. And the initial printing was large, but it couldn't cover the incredible demand, and that demand is only going to increase. And, you know, what's interesting is there are now many foreign publishers vying for the rights, including three from Russia.
See, the Russians love this stuff, and I want you to wrap up with the Kennedy-Khrushchev topic that we were talking about, and then we'll go to Holmes and some phone calls. People are lining up for you.
Actually, these are all connected, as you're going to hear in the next 20-some minutes. After we did the press conference at the Press Club, which is a very prestigious place,
yes,
we had a packed room, we had a lot of American press, we had four Russian television networks who showed up. Now, as you've noticed, not a peep has been appearing in the American press on what we did and what we said and what we presented, right?
Right.
Not the same in Russia. We have become the darling of the Russian media, so announced by Russian producers who have been in touch with us almost daily for the last month since we did the press conference, have asked for interviews, have asked for us to do television. We have now appeared on the front page of a couple of the major Moscow papers. All of this press coverage from the most surprising quarter, Russia, the former Soviet Union, led by, you know, Premier Khrushchev, seems to be driven by this intense interest in what Kennedy and Khrushchev tried to do for the entire human family 40 years ago that got shot down. Because remember, Kennedy got killed 10 days after Khrushchev had agreed, right?
Yep.
Less than a year later, Premier Khrushchev was given the boot.
Yep, he was out.
The chairmanship, the premiership, and Brezhnev took over, and basically Khrushchev was kept under house arrest for the rest of his life. So I believe there were dark forces on both sides that did not want these two men, on behalf of humanity, to go to the moon and discover and then make public what was there. And the Russian response is so interesting because we're all over the press. If you go to enterprisemission.com, you'll find major pieces on the main page linking to the earlier coverage, the current coverage, future coverage. There's links in Russian. There's translations in English. There's all the questions and answers that I was sent by this one major Moscow newspaper, which we put up the English version so you can read the very interesting multi-level questions that they're asking. And they have actually now asked me, the science editor of one of the papers has asked me if there's a way he can get hold of certain of the astronauts to ask them the questions that we were asked at the press club. So this is going to build, George. This is not a 90-day wonder on the 91st day. This is going to build, and I'm projecting there's going to be some major new Russian initiatives and interviews with us the first week in December, which, of course, is the next time the space shuttle, Atlantis this time, is going to fly, and I don't think that timing is accidental on the Russians' part.
All right, that'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. And speaking of the moon, if it wasn't for the full moon this weekend, we'd get another glimpse of Comet Holmes, which has, in pieces, starting to disintegrate or blow up. What's happening to that thing?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. When it first happened, and I'll get back to that date in a minute, I took Robin out, and, you know, we lay out in launchers with binoculars, and we're here in this incredible clear skies of New Mexico. And she was able to see it, and I'm able to see it, and we've kind of watched it over the last several weeks with our comings and goings. It is now bigger, George, than the sun. It is a spherical globe of dust, ice particles and dust and whatever, that erupted from this little tiny nucleus that may be something like a mile or two across, that was located in an orbit almost halfway between Earth and Jupiter, over two times as far from the sun as we are, and in the wee hours of October 23rd, 24th, suddenly something happened, and in the space of a few hours, this object went from 17th magnitude to something like 4th or 5th magnitude. In other words, it became brighter by a factor of a million times.
Now, when you say something happened, I mean, what are the possibilities?
Well, it's so cold out there. I mean, you're well beyond Mars, which is 1.5 times as far from the sun.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the temperatures out there are below the freezing point of water. They're below the freezing point of most, you know, volatiles and gases. These objects have no internal heat. There's no radioactivity. Something so tiny, a couple of miles across, I mean, you know, the size of Manhattan or less, could not have any internal energy at all. So the big mystery is, why did it suddenly, literally, blow up? It was discovered 115 years ago on the night of November 6, 1892, by a guy named Edwin Holmes.
Barely discovered. They could barely see it,
right? That's right. It was so dim, you know, and there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of comets that circle the sun, some of them periodically so that you see them every, you know, year or two or three or 4 years. Some of them every once every few thousand years. Those are first-time comets. This thing is a regular comet. It goes around the sun, I think, every 3 or 4 years. Nothing remarkable until the night of October 23rd. Now, here's where things get really, really weird, George.
All right.
This is a classic coast mystery. Everybody fasten your seatbelt.
Here we go.
The night the Comet Holmes blew up, when it was projected against the background of the constellation of Perseus, it was in exactly the same place in the sky. If you're looking from the Earth up into the heavens, mm-hmm. against the constellation where in 1996 and 1997, exactly 1 year apart, two incredibly bright comets, Hayataka, which was the Japanese comet in 1996, and then Comet Hale-Bopp in 1997 crossed orbits, like railroad tracks, or like you're looking down on a map and you see two rows that cross. The paths of these two comets crossed in space exactly 1 year apart back in 96-97.
Okay.
In 2007, in October, on the night of October 23rd, Comet Holmes blows up at exactly the same spot in space.
All right. To me, then, it sounds like there's some kind of dark matter wall there or something.
Not quite.
No.
Because you know what the night of October 23rd was?
No.
The night of the launch of Space Shuttle Discovery by NASA.
What's the significance of that?
Somebody's doing this.
You mean you think we blew up that comet?
No, the secret space program. Have you been following what Linda Howe has been reporting on her website?
Oh, yes, yes.
And what you and I have discussed many times. We had a panel with David Livingston, Rick Sterling, and you and me. We talked about the secret space program. George, there is no way that you could calculate the odds of all of these celestial events happening in the same spot in the sky, separated by a year and then 10 years, unless somebody was doing it.
But, Richard, do you know how far away the comet was and is?
Yeah, but you know what the secret space program has in the way of propulsion?
No.
If they've got anti-gravity spaceships, if that's one of the reasons why NASA went to the moon, to bring back technology and back engineer it, remember the piece of videotape that I took to Art and I loaned him for like a year or two, and he sat on it. He didn't say a word. which was a piece of shuttle video showing amazing spaceships in Earth orbit doing phenomenal things.
Yes, I remember.
And I told him at the time, I said, Art, they're our stuff. That's our guys in the secret space program. And more evidence has accumulated. I mean, you have had a very interesting guy on named Joseph Farrell, Dr. Joseph Farrell, who's written a series of books. He has incredible documentation. I mean, you think I'm nuts about documenting things. I mean, Joe makes me look like a piker. He put notes and documents and documents and documents. He has got a paper trail going all the way back to the Nazis before World War II, looking into technology which can only be hyperdimensional for the control of gravity and the creation of anti-gravity propulsion technology. We know that we got a bunch of Germans, including Wernher von Braun, in Paperclip in World War II, do we not?
Well, we do.
Okay. So what if they also brought over and kept secret the Nazi experiments in anti-gravity technology and a two-track space program was set up? One NASA in public view, using rockets, using something simple, using something primitive, using something very limited, hiding the real space program, which, of course, is what we've been using to do all kinds of interesting things, including bring back technology from all over the solar system and all those ruins out there that we've documented, up to and including keeping the Soviets at bay. And when Kennedy proposed sharing our space programs, that was the last straw. And back to what we said before, that's why he had to be killed, because that's the biggest secret.
East of the Rockies, you're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Wow. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Hi, this is Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Richard.
Good evening,
hi.
Bill.
Yes, hi. You know I'm an amateur astronomer, and I know space and astronomy, and I hate to put cold water on your theory that John F. Kennedy and NASA in 1963 and prior might have known about alien artifacts on the moon. I'm going to name three space missions, and then I have a second question I want to add about the mission Planck in 2008. Question number one, Ranger Surveyor Lunar Orbiter, meaning those unmanned missions which started from between 1966 and ended in early 68, came after JFK was dead, and Lunar Orbiter took the first close-up pictures of the whole moon. So how could NASA have known, or John F. Kennedy in 1963, about the alien artifacts?
One at a time. Go ahead, Richard.
I'm going to give you the incredibly important answer. They had prior knowledge. Okay?
A prior craft, a prior ranger, something.
Well, I believe prior documents. Remember, if the stuff we're seeing on the moon and on Mars and on the moons of Jupiter and on, you know, Iapetus and Saturn and all that is our stuff from our great-great-great-great-great ancestors, then records of that as ancient, sacred, secret documents handed down as the most revered and treasured archives in the history of humanity would have devolved through secret societies to certain groups over time.
I'm going to give you that. That's very possible.
So I believe that's the basis of the knowledge of everybody involved in this secret game, that there's something out there to go get. And all you have to do is create the technology in the 20th century to go get it.
All right, next question, Bill.
Okay, question number two. Next year, 2008, ESA, meaning the European Space Agency, will launch, hopefully July 31st, the Planck mission. Planck is the follow-up to NASA's WMAP, Wilkinson Microwave and Isotropy Probe mission, and before that, COBE. And I'm hoping, and I want to ask you, will Planck show evidence, because it's going to investigate the 3-degree background radiation left over from the Big Bang, far more sensitive than WMAP was. Will it show evidence of the multiverse or hyperdimensional theory of yours?
I'm not certain, but there's a really interesting mystery regarding this 3-degree background radiation. In the current issue of Scientific American, there is a very important, Astronomy for December of 2007. There's a very interesting article with images and photographs and data which lays out the most bizarre coincidence that the cosmic background radiation, this very subtle 3-degree Kelvin glow from supposedly the early universe, is somehow symmetrically arrayed around the solar system. In other words, it is aligned with the Earth's orbit and the orbit of all the planets around the sun. So Tom Van Flandern and I are beginning to believe that this background radiation is not from the cosmic Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago at all, Bill. We think it might be the leftover radiation from the explosion of Planet 5 65 million years ago, which, of course, would be neatly symmetric around the solar system because the explosion was in the plane of the planets orbiting the sun.
Let's go to the international line. Richard C., you're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Hi, we're in Victoria, British Columbia.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Just want to say thanks, you guys, for being so helpful, teaching us everything. And I just wanted to ask Richard if he knew anything about the Blue Beam project. Basically, I think they're going to use it, if they've still got it operational, to sort of dupe us into believing anything coming in is unfriendly. And I think that maybe there's more friendly ones coming our way sooner than later. And I just wondered what Richard thought.
All right, Richard, you've talked about this before.
Well, yeah, remember Carol Rosen, who worked for von Braun toward the end of his life and his career at NASA and then Fairchild, had conversations with him where he said basically that after they, you know, exhausted all the terrestrial fake, you know, terrorist ideas, that they'd go to an alien invasion. If you've got secret anti-gravity technology, George, the thing I've been always concerned about, and I discussed this with Art, and I've discussed it with you, is that you can basically create a false flag operation that looks like it's aliens, but in fact it's your secret space program stuff. And we need to be wary and put out the word that if this technology exists, there are bad guys that might use it in their last desperate, last-ditch effort to basically terrorize us into giving away the rest of our rights.
It's almost like we're living a movie, Richard.
We are. We are. Come on. The lie is different at every level.
Man.
And only, you know, as Ben Franklin said, when the woman said outside Independence Hall, what kind of a government do we have, Mr. Franklin, 200 and some years ago? He said, madam, you have a republic if you can keep it. You know, freedom and responsibility go hand in hand. Eternal vigilance. This is why I think John Kennedy was the last real president, because he tried to be president. And in his name and his honor and his memory, we need to remember who we are. And in this next election, we have to make extraordinarily careful decisions.
Well, Benjamin Franklin also said, paraphrasing, go fly a kite. So what does that make you? Let's go to our last caller here, Richard. You're on the air west of the Rockies. Go ahead really quickly.
Yeah, this is John in Westminster.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that there's been a number of people that have all claimed the same thing regarding launches out of Area 51 with the Aurora project. Phil Schneider was one, William Cooper, Ben Rich. There was a Nexus article interview with a Jesuit priest that says the Vatican is launching things for 51. They can. John Lear says that his intelligence people say they can be to from Area 51.
Of course, Schneider's dead, Cooper's dead. I don't know how many others are.
Well, Ben Rich died of natural causes, but Ben Rich was the head of the Skunk Works, the Lockheed Skunk Works, and in his latter days, he was making some very interesting pronouncements that are exactly coincident with what this caller is saying. Look, bottom line, the evidence says there's a secret two-track program, that gravity is controllable, we've got the shuttle videos, that the NASA program we see is a false front Western town, and you got to hand it to those astronauts who get into that rattle trap called the shuttle, because if they know that there's a better game in town and it wouldn't put their lives at risk, they're incredibly heroic and courageous because they believe they're doing the right thing for God, America, and country.
All right, Richard C. Hoagland, thank you. Good luck again with Dark Mission, website darkmission.net. It's a New York Times bestseller, primarily because of you, the listeners here on this incredible program. But it's a great message, Richard. Richard, good luck, and keep us informed on your happenings, okay?
Thanks, George. I surely will.
That's Richard C. Hoagland. I shall be back in a moment, because now we begin our Moonlight Madness Open Lines. 3 hours of open lines for you right here on Coast to Coast AM.